Welcome, everybody, to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anyone who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. This is a series of deep conversations that I convened in order to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by deepening our public dialogue about how a higher consciousness can play a role in helping human beings rise to meet our current extreme challenges and make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. At this point, I've held almost 60 profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm joined by John Bunzel, and we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation we've decided to title A New Global Activism. The way this will work is that I'll introduce John and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions and finish up in about 90 minutes. John Bunzel is a businessman and the founder of the Simultaneous Policy, SIMPOL, campaign, a campaign that Ken Wilber has described as a second-tier political practice that makes a great deal of sense and is certainly worth backing. He's also the author of The Simultaneous Policy, An Insider's Guide to Saving Humanity and the Planet, and People-Centered Global Governance, Making It Happen. He's also the co-author of Monetary Reform, Making It Happen, with the prominent monetary reformer James Robertson. He's lectured widely, including at the Schumacher Society, the World Trade Organization, the Lucius Trust, and at various universities. He's a company director living in London, and he has three children. What I especially appreciate about John and his work is that he really is a sterling example of someone who's passionately thinking outside the dots in order to unlock the seeming stuckness of our larger systems and create openings for creativity and responsibility to break through the seeming dysfunction of so many of our institutions and patterns. So I'm really happy to welcome you, John, as my guest this morning.
Thank you very much, Terry. I'm delighted to be here, and it's a real privilege to be part of such a really wonderful series of interviews. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, why don't we plunge right into this by giving you an opportunity to tell everyone exactly what SIMPOL is and why it's, you know, worth understanding and paying attention to and maybe getting involved with. Can you just orient us with kind of an opening volley?
Yes, sure. I will be delighted to do that. I mean, in a nutshell, sort of elevator pitch for it would be that it's a way that citizens in democratic countries can use their votes in a completely new way to drive their politicians to cooperate globally to solve global problems. Now, the simultaneous policy is two things. It's actually a policy and a process. So as a policy, it can include probably a whole range of policies. The actual policy itself hasn't yet been defined. It's being defined by citizens who sign on to the campaign. And it can include basically any policy that is desirable, but which nations cannot implement unilaterally. They cannot implement on their own because they fear that their economy will become uncompetitive. So, for example, a perfect example of that, Terry, would be drastic cuts in carbon emissions, where any nation that implemented a fairly stringent carbon emissions reduction program would, of course, heap greater costs onto its industries. Its industries would then have higher costs, would then become uncompetitive with their competitors in other countries. Thousands of jobs would be lost, so it doesn't happen. And, of course, every country is in the same predicament. They're all playing the same game. They're all none of them can move because they fear moving first will ruin their economy. So, as a policy, SIMPOL can include any policy that falls into that category. So we're talking about carbon emissions reduction, we're talking about a currency transactions tax, we're talking about regulations on corporations, we're talking about corporate tax. I mean, the list is almost endless. I mean, you could almost say that Simpol could include virtually every global requirement or policy demand that the global justice movement is currently wanting, but can't get implemented. So that's Simpol as a policy, and it's, as I say, it's being developed by citizens who sign on to the campaign, and I can explain more about how that process works. But the other side of Simpol is that it's also a process. It's a political process for how we get those policies implemented. And it's very simple. What we're actually asking people to do when they sign on is just simply to write to their politicians and say, hey guys, I'll be voting in future national elections for any politician or party within reason that has pledged to implement the simultaneous policy alongside other governments. And so if you think about that, rather than sort of voting Republican or Democrat or Labour or Conservative or whatever your political parties are, you're instead saying, well, look, we're going to make our own policy. It's called the simultaneous policy, and we'll be voting for any of you that signs up to it within, you know, with any of you within reason that signs up to it. And so we're placing politicians in a far stiffer competition with one another. Because if you you probably realize that many elections and parliamentary or congressional seats around the world are being won and lost these days on very, very fine margins. And therefore, it won't take many people to sign on to Simpol to make it in the vital survival interests of the politicians to sign on. And in fact, you know, in the last national election here in the UK, which was in 2010, and with actually very few of us involved in Simpol still here in the UK, we actually got 200 candidates from all the main political parties to sign on to this. And of those, 24 are now sitting in Parliament. And the interesting thing is that in many parliamentary seats, both or all three of the main, because we have like three main parties here, all three of the main party candidates signed on. So whichever of them won the seat, Simpol had a representative in Parliament. And so, you know, this is really what I'm trying to explain to people is that this is a really a new way of doing politics. Because many of us, I think, these days have become incredibly switched off politics because we don't see it as delivering a solution to the world's problems. And of course, we're right. It can't in its current context, at its current level of development, because, as I said, all political parties and governments are in this vicious circle of having to keep their national economies internationally competitive. And that means, of course, that the policies they can implement are, you know, restricted now to a very narrow market and business-friendly range. And therefore, it's not surprising that politics has become meaningless to people. But if we're going to solve global problems, to my mind, we can't do this without politics. So we need to come back to politics, but we need to re-engage with it at a higher level, at a level where we take control, where we say we'll make our own global policy and we'll get we'll force the politicians and parties to compete with one another to sign up to it. So I hope that hasn't bombarded you with too much information.
No, no, but that's great. I think we need to lay all this out in a very clear way. That was beautiful. So taking it a step further, if somebody signs up for Simpol, how then do they engage with you in order to, you know, say they find this interesting and exciting?
Right.
How do they engage?
Well, the first thing they do is they can go to simpol.org, which is our website. You can sign on. It just takes a couple of minutes. It's completely free. And then we have a little template letter that you can send to your congressman or your member of parliament. Or particularly at election times, we would ask you to send it to all the competing candidates for your area. And that's the first step. So that's if you like, the process side. That's each of us saying, hey, I'm going to be voting for any politician or party within reason that signs on to Simple. Then on top of that, you can actually engage in the policy development side, which is, as I said, that's the policy side of Simple. In other words, what are the policies going to be? And many citizens are actually putting forward not necessarily their own policy ideas, because obviously we as individuals are not necessarily great experts in policy making. But a lot of Simpol supporters are actually proposing policies that have been developed by non-governmental organizations, which are actually quite well worked out policies. So basically, you're engaging in two ways. It's like global direct democracy in action. You're using your national vote in a way to drive politicians to cooperate, to implement the simultaneous policy, and at the same time, you can contribute to what those policies are actually going to be.
Now, just taking this into account, gosh, there's a couple of different directions I want to go with you, John. One of them is to... kick the tires of this and as a devil's advocate and really get you to unpack your thinking at a deeper level. I want to do that. But before I do, let me loop around. Most of the conversations I've had in this series have been about the inner work rather than the outer work. And this is clearly focused on outer work. And yet you've been a very deep, serious student, very influenced by integral theory, and you regard mm-hmm. this as something that comes out of your own integral impulse. I think it would be good to talk about this in terms of the inner work, in terms of the fact that this includes interiors as well as exteriors. It's not just a strategy for political effectiveness. It's also a way of including your whole person, and that in some sense it comes from an integrative level of your own consciousness. Why don't you take a moment to help us understand that?
Definitely. Now, I'm glad you asked that, Terry, because actually I tend to focus on the outer logic of Simple. And actually, as you say, there's a very, very deep inner engagement there, which actually came to me back in 1998. It was almost like an altered state experience where I was just having this conversation over dinner with my family, and they were talking about climate change and all these things, and my mother just said, well, what would you do about it? And in that moment, I went inside myself in a very deep way, and I think I realized, particularly because I'm a businessman, I can see how competition very much constrains us, all of us. So, for example, I realized that if I, as a businessman, if my profits go down, and if I don't kick out 50 people today, I'll become uncompetitive, and my business will probably be taken over by someone else. So, and then I'll have to kick out even more people later, and therefore I have to kick 50 people out today, even though I don't want to. And so competition. So I suppose what I'm saying, Terry, is that I felt in this very deep sense that we are all one, in the sense that we are all stuck in this, with these constraints, and that while we're really not to blame, we're all jointly responsible. And the idea of simultaneity, of simultaneously implementing policies globally, creates a kind of new context. It means that in the current context of competition, we're very much constrained. But if we all do this simultaneously, if we implement these policies simultaneously, we open up a new world of possibilities in which win-win solutions can come to be implemented. And so, for me, it was very much like moving up from out of this you know, what I would say is like in spiral dynamics, green or yellow, where we tend to, or particularly in green, where we tend to blame corporations, we tend to blame politicians, to realizing that actually, if I was in their shoes, I'd probably have to do pretty much the same thing. And therefore, I am they are me, and we are one. And that as a result, we can forgive ourselves, but at the same time, through simultaneous action, we can commit to solving the problem together. And we create a non-judgmental space in which we can come together to say, okay, you know, we actually all want to solve climate change, and if we do it together, actually nobody need lose out. If we do it simultaneously.
The thing that I appreciate and that I want to join with you in talking about here is that Simpol gives us an opportunity to to pass laws in separate countries that don't get implemented until enough countries pass the same law, but it builds momentum for positive changes that otherwise there's no mechanism to implement. Is that
that's right? Yeah.
So
yeah,
it breaks the stuckness of the game.
That's precisely it. It breaks the vicious circle. So I mean, in practice, what the laws would actually be, you know, the simultaneous policy would be the laws as it evolves, and then when you have all or sufficient nations on board and who've signed up to this as a result of the political process I described, then on a given date, those laws would be implemented by every nation on the same day. Now, I should stress that we're not talking here about a one-size-fits-all. We're talking about, for example, if you take an individual nation, Terry, if you take income tax, you know, the rich pay more and the poor pay less. And it would be a similar situation globally where, you know, some nations would cut their emissions more than others. Some wouldn't have to cut them at all and could actually expand them. But it would to be implemented simultaneously with certain compensations and mixing issues, so that what nations may lose on, say, a climate agreement, they can gain on a currency transactions tax. You know, in that way, we're creating a framework of cooperation and a political process to implement those laws. Now, I know that sounds quite complicated, it is an evolving process, which many of the details of which we have to actually work out as we go along.
Well, one of the things that this points to, that I think is important for us all to really look at, is I often refer in these dialogues in a rather general way to the fact that our problems seem insoluble, that it takes a different kind of consciousness to deal with them, and yet the detail of how that has worked itself into being is not usually unpacked in detail in these dialogues, and yet there is some value in looking really closely at the mechanisms through which market competition is working. One of the things that is daunting is the way that, in a sense, the international corporations, international marketplaces for goods and services, and increasingly international marketplaces for people's attention, tends to drive a vicious cycle among media persuasion, political donations, political influence, corporate influence over politics, corporate influence over people's attitudes, the kind of hypnotic effect of media, all these things feeding together to draw us all into a shared trance in which the only thing driving it is profitability and therefore the consumption of the Earth's resources and the destruction of our life support systems. And it's as if nobody is in charge. Everybody is really
That's
a functionary
right.
in a larger system without a whole lot of original choice. Everybody's
precisely.
You know, the
CEOs,
the presidents, everybody's beholden to. We got to have growth. We've got to have profit. We've got to succeed. And every one of us, with the financial necessities in our own lives, have to be part then of the system. But the system itself is pathological and out of control. How do you break out of that? And then this is, I think, the fundamental insight that we haven't unpacked so much in this series that you're feeling and addressing with this, that I feel, you know, very appreciative that you're addressing.
No, that's absolutely right, Terry. And you know, your point about no one being in control, I think, is very apt, because, you know, to me, it's a little bit like we're all in this jet. You know, politicians and businessmen are sitting in first class and the rest of us are in coach. You know, the plane's kind of veering dangerously out of control, and you know, everyone expects you know, the politicians to actually be in the cockpit, but they're not. You know, someone opens the door and there's nobody in there, you know, and it's actually the politicians are just as constrained, and business people themselves are just as constrained as the rest of us, for the reasons I've been explaining. You know, business people, you know, it's as they say, if we don't do it, our competition will. You know, if Shell doesn't ruin the Ogoni Delta in Nigeria, Texaco will only be too happy to take its place. You know, so the need to keep your profits up and to keep your share price up drives, as you say, this vicious circle. And for politicians, likewise, you know, politicians cannot regulate or tax because, you know, the bankers or the rich or the corporations, because if they try to, they'll go elsewhere and they'll just lose, you know, that country will lose out. So, you know, this is a plane that's out of control. It's a system, as you say, Terry, that's out of control. And it's what I'm really trying to offer, I guess, with Simpol is a way for us collectively to get into the cockpit. Because when we are at a postmodern level of political development, we blame corporations, we blame our governments, we put ourselves, I would say, into a position of adolescent dependency. We think they are going to solve the problem for us. But when we move up to an integral level of political engagement, we kind of realize that, you know, we're going to have to do this ourselves, and that we need a process, a global process, a win-win process under which we can collectively get into that cockpit, take back control, and hopefully land the plane safely before it crashes. You know, so that's, you know, that's right. But this idea, as you say, of it being a system that is really no one is in control of, I think is very important. And it's scary because it means we have to take responsibility, and people don't like to do that. But that's exactly what we have to do. That's exactly what globalization, I think, is calling humanity to do, is to take responsibility, to grow up, to say, okay, we have to deal with this.
Well, I very much resonate with that. I resonate with the passion that makes you an activist of this kind, who's trying to look at the patterns that tend to keep the game self-limited, self-limiting, unable to exceed its own premises. All of that resonates. But then when I get down to cases, I begin having all kinds of questions. Like, for instance, Exxon, which has been a terrible corporate citizen. They financed a lot of the disinformation campaign that has confused the public perception in the United States of the realities of the science around global warming, for example. Went through a change of management, and since that time have embraced the idea of a carbon tax. Now, if a carbon tax could be passed in the United States, that would be fantastic. But if Simpol became more well known in the United States and began to influence things, I could imagine some conservatives who don't want to see any carbon tax in the United States seize upon the arguments you've made and say, well, hey, you know, there might be some Republicans and conservatives willing to pass a carbon tax now that we've got Chevron and some others behind it, but we shouldn't do that yet. We should wait until everybody else does it too, and it, in this same logic, could be used to delay what little progressive movement might be possible immediately. How do you account for that?
Well, very easily. I mean, obviously, I mean, in a general sense, you know, you will have a lot of people in business who will be against global regulations, Terry. No doubt about it. But I think as time goes on and as our problems get worse and more apparent, that, you know, though the people who today may be against something like SimPol, I think are going to be calling for it, because by then it'll be the only way to get out of the hole. The other point is that if we use our votes in the way that SimPol suggests, and you know, we can get into a situation where we hold the balance of power between the two main parties, and therefore you could arrive at a situation where both Republicans and Democrats have no choice but to sign up to SimPol, simply because if one does and the other doesn't, the other one's going to lose out, so they're both going to sign up. And that regardless of corporate funding. I mean, if you just rewind the tape to the year 2000, Terry, and I know I'm talking quite simplistically now, and I'm English, so forgive me if I'm a little ignorant of the system, but, you know, if we had, say, I don't know, just say 5 or 10,000 people in Florida who were supporting SimPol, and, you know, we wind ourselves back to just before that election, and you had Bush's pollster coming in to see him to say, well, George, it's all on a knife edge, you know, it could go either way. But there's about 10,000 people in Florida willing to, who will be voting for either Republican or Democrat. They don't care. Whoever signs on to SimPol will get their vote. You know, you can well imagine that, you know, that the Republicans are going to have to sign up, because if they don't, they could lose to the Democrats, who probably signed up anyhow.
Well, but I've got an objection to that idea.
Yep.
Because there are a lot of other activists who are trying to throw their weight around. So you've got the nurses union, and you've got the environmental conservation voters organization, and you've got the people for the ethical treatment of animals, and you've got the women's rights organization, you've got the gay rights organization. You've got so many advocates who are coming to the politicians and saying, if you pay attention to our issue, we will vote for you. And it's very, very hard to get an individual activist, even me, even the people on this phone, perhaps even you in certain circumstances, to say, well, SimPol is the one issue over and above, as much as I might care about environmental issues, as much as I might care about financial reform issues, as much as I might care about campaign finance reform issues, this is the one. Well, there's going to be advocates for a lot of things that I believe in, trying to persuade politicians that that's the thing that they ought to support. How can you be heard over that din effectively, especially because it's so difficult to get a message to lodge?
Right. Well, you know, the first thing, this is where the consciousness comes in. When you see this vicious circle of global competition, when you move up to a world-centric level of conscious, of political or civic consciousness, as I call it, Terry, you start to see that actually solving, you know, breaking this vicious circle is actually the most important thing, because all these other issues you start to see are actually subsidiary. Now, I know a lot of people may object to that, and if you brought up, you know, for example, nurses might be complaining that, you know, they're not being paid enough. You know, nurses say, for example, in Britain, may say they're not being paid enough. And I would say, well, the reason governments are not paying nurses sufficiently is because they can't raise sufficient tax from the rich or the corporations. Why? Because they're able to move elsewhere. You know, so a lot of these subsidiary issues, the same with environmental groups, a lot of these subsidiary issues, when you actually think about it, lead back to this vicious circle. They lead back to the fact that we're living at a time where the economy has gone global, but governance is only national. So anything that can actually move globally can outmaneuver national governments. And that means that, you know, a lot of the national constituencies, as you talk about, whether it's nurses or human rights groups or environmental groups, when your consciousness moves up to a world-centric level, you start to see that actually some kind of global cooperation is really the most important thing. Because until you have that, nothing lower down the system is never going to be solved. So that's one point, and that's why Simpol is a slow burner, Terry. You know, a lot of people, if they're not at a world-centric level of consciousness, they won't even resonate with it. They won't even, you know, they'll say, well, you know, we don't, you know, I'm much more interested in local issues and doing something locally now. I'm not interested in something like Simpol. You know, that's where a lot of people are at. But I think as time goes on, people are going to see that, you know, their local or national predicament is heavily influenced by this global vicious circle we've been talking about. And the other point I would make is that we are applying political pressure. We're not just vying for attention. You know, we are prepared to vote for either party within reason. I think most environmental groups are probably trying to get their agenda pressed on to the Democrats because they know they haven't got a hope with the Republicans. But what we're doing is something much more powerful. We're actually saying we will be voting for either of you, which that signs up. So, you know, there's two points there, I think. And does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does begin to address it, and in some really useful ways. And, okay, let me imagine myself this year. How would I justify voting for Mitt Romney for president if Mitt Romney said he would sign up for Simpol and it hadn't reached the radar for Barack Obama, when I see so many egregious, retrogressive policy positions in his platform?
Yeah. Well, first of all, when I said, you know, we played, people who sign on to Simpol, supporters of Simpol, pledge to vote for any candidate or politician or party within reason that has pledged to implement Simpol. Now, that phrase, within reason, Terry, is critical, because if you personally find Mitt Romney so abhorrent that you couldn't possibly vote for him, even if he has signed on to Simpol, well, you don't have to, because for you, he's not within reason, right?
Sure.
So you see, Simpol doesn't. You know, when you sign on to the campaign, Terry, you don't lose your right to vote as you please. Ultimately, what you're doing is you're saying, you're giving a very powerful indication to politicians that you're going to be giving very strong preference to politicians who signed on to the campaign, and you're very likely, you're highly unlikely to vote for candidates who have not signed on to the campaign. Okay, so it's not an absolute, I'm not asking you.
On the other hand, though, you are suggesting, though, that I ought to make this international view, this simultaneous policy criterion, very, very high on my list of criteria, that even though a candidate might in many respects seem more congenial, I might still vote for a different one within reason, simply because this criterion really ought to rise above others.
That's true, Terry, yes. And I believe that, you know, as time goes on and as people's consciousness deepens, they will see that global cooperation, to rein in a global economy is the key issue. However, don't forget that, you know, as our numbers grow, Two things. Sorry. First of all, don't forget that a politician doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to implement SMPL until all or sufficient nations are on board. Because obviously the policy, nothing actually gets implemented until all or sufficient nations are on board, and then it all gets implemented on the same date. Okay, the particular policy gets implemented on the same date. So until that day arrives, there's nothing for a politician to, he doesn't have to implement anything until then. And so it's really a win-win for politicians, you know, and therefore, you know, if we get to the point where Mitt Romney has signed on to SMPL, the chances are that Barack Obama will already have signed on to it anyhow. You know, so, you know, because our voting power will by then, as a bloc, will have become strong enough so that both candidates, both sides, will have had to sign on to this. And then, of course, you can vote for Barack Obama, Terry. No problem.
Right. Well, you know, taking this a level further, one of the deepest realizations that has clarified for me is that a political movement based merely on strategic thinking, and I think what you're describing here might be called meta-systemic strategic thinking, very, very deep, very broad strategic thinking, but still strategic thinking. I've come to feel that I actually need to shift my very way of being, that in some way my politics, my activism has to flow from a deep practice. And I need to cohere in an emerging evolutionary community of practitioners, of people who are evolving profoundly and who are not just citizens voting on the basis of issues and analysis in the way that is described in conventional news reports, but growing in my very way of being and my presence so that I am a presence of love and consciousness and inquiry more and more and more deeply, and by my very presence I'm influencing others to a greater depth, and I am co-creating and co-evolving a different kind of polity. That's my own disposition and realization. It's in the context of that that I find SMPL interesting, but not in itself sufficient. It would only make sense to me to make SMPL the centerpiece of what I'm doing. Well, it can only be a centerpiece of what I'm doing, one of the ways that I'm expressing my integral consciousness, because I think that we need to become a different kind of we, and we need to be evolving even the kind of discourse that we have. And merely strategically analyzing and trying to solve problems, the complexity of our world is exceeding our ability to analyze. We do need to operate on the basis of our best strategic plans, for sure, but not with the hubris of imagining that we can figure it all out and anticipate all the possibilities. And in some sense, we have to come together at a different level of being as practitioner activists. That it's only that way that we can enact an integral revolution that really will transform things. And clearly we need to unlock the game, and we need mechanisms like SMPL that can break out of the mindless machine of more that global economy can tend to be. Mm-hmm. But it would not be only that would embody my politics. How do you respond to that?
I would totally agree with you, Terry. I mean, you know, SMPL is certainly a way in which we can bring about a rebalancing of the world, in the sense that, you know, to me it's a little bit like you know, as I said, the economy and market competition, which I kind of regard in a sense as the masculine principle, has reached the global level. But governance, cooperative governance, the feminine principle, is still only at the national level. So SMPL, if you like, is a way of bringing that feminine governance principle up to the same global level as the economy. But and signing on to Simple, as I said, just takes a couple of minutes. So you know, by no means is it the only thing you need to do, or the only thing you can do. I'm just saying that it is one of the, it is one of the ingredients of a new integral being in the world, which is exactly what you're talking about. It's just one aspect of it, but it's not the whole. It's not the whole story by any means. I totally agree with you about that.
Well, in that spirit, you've wandered beyond simply a focus on Simple, and you've authored a couple of other books, and one notably on monetary reform. I'm curious to hear a little bit about the core thesis of that book and analysis.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, actually, that does come back to Simple, because this again, Terry, is what I mean about global cooperation now being the most important thing in the world. And I'll explain, monetary reform is a great example, because quite often when you talk about what's wrong with the system, the informed people will say, but it's the way the banks create money. The commercial banks actually create 97% of all money, in the sense of not just cash, but also credit. And, that is because interest is paid on that. It's like a Ponzi scheme, and that's why we periodically have financial crises. And therefore, they will say you must restore the creation of new money to the state or to the public control.
Or they want to go back on the gold standard.
Potentially, but one way or another, what they want is to bring the creation of new money back under some kind of public control and accountability. And
right.
my response to that is, yes, that is absolutely vital. However, given that the banks and the can move their operations globally these days, and markets are global, any nation that tried to implement monetary reform, the restoration of the issuing of new money to the state, would only sort of invite a complete economic collapse for their nation. And so what I'm saying is effectively that in a global context, monetary reform can only be implemented safely if all or sufficient nations do it together simultaneously. And therefore, what's the most important thing? Is it monetary reform or is it global cooperation?
Yeah.
Do you follow me?
Yeah.
And so this is what I mean by deepening consciousness, Terry. It's there are many, many problems in the world. Monetary reform is one of them. Climate change is another one. The list is endless. But when you really think deeply about these things, you see that in most cases they come back in a globalized world to this point that we need. In a globalized world, you're going to have global cooperation and simultaneously implemented policies. It's like this is like a no-brainer.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, this is something that's been broadly talked about by some of the people who've been guests on this series in the past, both Ken Wilber and Steve McIntosh, especially Steve, have focused on world federation, global governance, and the path to global governance often is a topic of debate. How do we arrive there? And it seems that it isn't going to be through simply championing the idea of a one-world government, because people already distrust their own governments, and a one-world government would seem to just globalize the kind of oppression that people experience from their national governments today. It seems that the way we can move in a healthy way toward world-centric governance, which is a hallmark of an integral consciousness, can see that we need meta-systemic solutions to our problems, and that one of those elements clearly is global governance mechanisms. But those global governance mechanisms are we simply have to strengthen different forms of international cooperation, And as much as possible, those need to bypass the corruption of money politics. And I think the grassroots nature of SimPol, at least at this stage of its manifestation, and the, you know, the clear concern for the good of all that are evidenced in your expression, you know, identify this as a healthy, positive move toward the kinds of global governance that are universally understood as an implication of any kind of integral reform of our lower right institutions.
Precisely, Terry, and that's something I'm very keen to stress, is that, you know, when we, again, this is part of our rational or what I would call nation-centric consciousness, is that when we talk about global governance, or when most people hear that phrase, what they conjure in their minds is their own national level of governance blown up to the global level. So if you live in the US, you think of the US government, but, you know, it's a global world government with a ruddy great bureaucracy and all the bad stuff that goes with that. And so that's why a lot of people are, you know, find the whole idea of global governance completely abhorrent, because they just think, oh my God, this is just going to be terrible. But that's because, we're thinking nation-centrically, and we're blowing up our nation-centric models of governance to the global level. But what SimPol does, it cuts through all of that, because it's saying, look, no, we're not going to have a bureaucracy. What we're going to do is to get people around the world to negotiate and design global policies, and then we're going to use our votes to drive our politicians to a point at which they have signed up to implementing these things simultaneously. And so if every nation implements it simultaneously, you get the effect of global governance, but without the global government, if you see what I mean. So you achieve the aim without the bureaucracy and all the, you know, all of that that goes with it. I mean, obviously, SimPol itself would to some extent have to develop systems of policy development, and I can talk more about that, Terry, about how we envisage that unfolding. But you know, the idea of nations globally and simultaneously implementing policies has a completely different flavor to it compared to a world government, right? And so I think something, you know, that the SimPol model offers a much more open and flat and people-centered solution to global governance than some kind of world government. And I would also say that we need to be careful, because if we citizens don't get with a plan like SimPol or something similar, what we're going to end up with is either collapse, or we will end up with a world government, and it'll be implemented by the corporations and the politicians, you know, probably as a result of a knee-jerk reaction to global chaos, and nobody's going to like that. So again, you know, as I say, we've got to take responsibility. We citizens, you know, we've got to get on with this now. We can't wait for things to get so bad that our politicians and the, you know, with their corporate cohorts, you know, implement something when the water gets up to our ears, you know.
Well, this makes total sense to me and seems incredibly relevant and timely in the UK and in the EU, because there are so many problems that are crossing national borders, particularly in the Eurozone, that require this kind of approach. It looks, you know, those listening to us here now are people from all over the world, but there are more in the United States than anywhere else. And I'm an American, and my, you know, I do my best to account for my, you know, U.S.-centric biases, but, you know, probably incompletely. But nonetheless, the United States matters tremendously in the world. It's certainly the most powerful economy, and we are in a terrible state of deadlock right now with Republicans who do not have a world-centric orientation putting pretty much of a stranglehold on even some of the basic functions of our government. So the possibility of the United States participating in something like CINPOL and of my political activism expressing itself primarily through something like CINPOL, well, it seems that we are not at the cutting edge of how this is going to get implemented anytime soon. And I wonder, you know, how you would persuade me to see CINPOL as a, you know, like getting my local candidates to embrace it, having more relevance than I'm tending to feel that it has now. I think it has tremendous relevance as a principle. I think the mechanism, it helps free my imagination. It helps make me feel that some of the stuckness can be broken through, but as an immediate short-term high-leverage tactic in my local environment, I feel some skepticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, Terry, you know, you don't, you know, CINPOL only applies to national candidates. Okay, so if you're talking about your congressional candidates or Senate candidates, you know, you wouldn't be writing to your local politicians in your state politicians necessarily, except for perhaps your senators. So with CINPOL, we're talking really only about the national level. Okay. We want to get national politicians to sign up to this. So, and then the other point I think is that, as we said before,
CINPOL is one of the things you would do.
Sorry,
I understood that it was national candidates, but even at the national level, and especially at the national level, we have that deadlock.
Mm. Well, indeed you do, and you know, I would say that. CINPOL isn't an answer to everything, and obviously you need to carry on trying to, as in each nation, national politics will still carry on, and you will still need to struggle as you do before. CINPOL can't necessarily solve all of that. All I would say is that, you know, in many respects, in the bigger picture, people will start to see that global global simultaneous policies are very important. For example, there was a lot of hope when Barack Obama became president, and we thought, well, things are really going to change because, you know, and there was in integral circles, there was a lot of discussion, well, is Barack Obama integral and all this sort of thing. But the point is that, as we've seen, he is very much locked in to keeping the U.S. economy internationally competitive. And therefore, the feasible policies that are open to him are incredibly narrow. Now, I know that isn't the whole story. There's a whole load of other issues going on in the states, and for that reason, you may well be right, Terry, that the states may not be the lead country or within the leading pack of nations where CINPOL evolves first, and by the look of it, it may be in Europe first. But I think as time goes on, and you know, these global issues start to impact more and more, and people's consciousness deepens more and more to realize that actually the lack of global cooperation is underlying a lot of these issues and a lot of these problems, then I think, you know, I was going to say even countries like the U.S. and citizens in the U.S. will I think warm up to this. But who knows? You know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But I'm just suggesting that could be how it unfolds.
No. I feel good about this, and you know, I want you to know that I've aired these devil's advocate kinds of questions and skepticisms in the spirit of trying to, you know, not trying to bat this down, but trying to, in a sense, lift up our level of dialogue so that it really grapples with all of our doubts and skepticism, so that maybe more of us can appreciate just what this is. I want to say that I have felt that CINPOL is very persuasive and inspiring because it helps me to see how I can be engaged in politics with a global view. But I know that it will be far more engaging when it's not just sign up for the CINPOL pledge, but it's, okay, pass this first CINPOL initiative. Now, I imagine one of the first initiatives has probably got to do with some kind of really intelligent, market-sensitive approach to the problems of global warming and carbon in the atmosphere, perhaps carbon
mm-hmm.
taxation or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Potentially, yes.
And another probably has to do with issues around monetary reform.
Mm-hmm.
What's your top list of at this point? I understand that
yeah.
you think that has to be surrendered to a larger body of decision makers,
this
is not your prerogative exclusively, but you have your opinions and perceptions, and what are they?
Yeah, well, that actually brings me on, Terry, if I may, to kind of explain how we envisage the policy development side of CIMPOL evolving. Because what we actually envisage is a two-stage process where supporters of CIMPOL in each country will initially have their own independent policy development processes. And so, for example, we had a vote here amongst supporters in the UK saying, well, what are your top 10 global issues and what are your top 10 policies to solve them? And if you go onto our UK website, which you can reach through our global site, you can see what those top 10 issues and policies are. Supporters in each nation will, of course, have a different view, and it's very important, therefore, that in the first stage, each nation or supporters in each nation have their own independent process so that their national perspective on global issues can come into the, can be fully taken into account. And then the second stage would only occur if and when support around, political support around the world for CIMPOL was really very well developed, and it had become a question not so much of if CIMPOL would be implemented, but when. Then you would have to have a global negotiation amongst not only the national CIMPOL organizations, but also non-democratic governments would have to be brought into the process. And at that point, you would hopefully be able to negotiate a final set of policies. And the important thing there, I think, is that CIMPOL is a multi-issue framework. The reason the world isn't solving its problems now is because we're just taking one issue at a time. So, for example, we're taking carbon emissions. But on any single issue like that, of course, there are nations that are going to win and there are nations that are going to lose. China and the US, the big polluting nations, are going to lose. So it's not surprising. They're not going to cooperate, right? But if you take alongside a climate agreement a currency transactions tax, which would also be implemented at the same time globally, the billions of dollars that you raise from the tax you could use to pay off the big losers on the climate part of the agreement. So in that way, by mixing two issues together, you can start to see that nations that may lose on one issue can gain on another. What one may lose on the swings, they can gain on the roundabouts. And so this framework of a multi-issue framework is what CIMPOL offers, which you just don't see in current UN-sponsored negotiations around the world, which is why they're always failing. To me, CIMPOL offers a vehicle where we can come together to propose and discuss and refine these kind of global measures that we know are necessary, but we equally know our governments can't or just not in a mindset to implement. And where we can also use our votes to drive politicians towards that aim. And I should just clarify, Terry, because I said that when you sign on to CIMPOL, you pledge to vote. Let me give you the full pledge, because when you sign on to CIMPOL, you vote in future national elections for any politician or party within reason that signs up to implementing CIMPOL. Or if you have a party political preference, you want your party to sign up to it. So, for example, this comes back to what you were saying earlier. If you absolutely can't bring yourself to vote for Mitt Romney, which I perfectly understand, my friend, CIMPOL doesn't commit you to doing that. For each of us as citizens, when you sign on to Simple, you're actually saying, you know, I'm going to be voting, I'm going to be giving very strong voting preference to candidates that have signed on to this, to the probable exclusion of those that haven't. And that's a very powerful statement for citizens to make. And I think it's, you know, what Simpol is about saying, I'm not going to be a global victim anymore. I'm going to get into the cockpit. I'm going to do my bit to produce the kind of global cooperation we need to solve these issues.
Well, thank you, John. We have not exhausted our dialogue, but we have exhausted our time. So I want to make a few announcements before we start taking some questions from others. Now, if you know, please think about these things, and let's get John to address our questions. So think about that, and please, if you're listening via webcast, type in the window on your web browser, in the Instant Teleseminar window, whatever question you have. If you phoned in, please press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And if you want to understand more about Simpol, you want to read more, there are videos, audios, articles, books, and a variety of more detailed information available at simpol.org, S-I-M-P-O-L.org. If you're interested in my work, there are a couple of upcoming events that I'd like to tell you about. I will be offering a 5-day deep experiential seminar on integral leadership at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia, Canada, June 15th through 20th. I've previously sometimes announced it June 10th through 15th. It's 15 through 20. And this is the single event all year where I'm going to give people an opportunity to work in person with me at some depth and explore and deepen your purpose and work and leadership and practice together in a really beautiful and nurturing container. I've put together a detailed description of how this program will combine deep personal work, a profound we space among a whole group of integral leaders and individuals growing in their capacity for leadership, and also mastering state-of-the-art integral leadership skills. So please go to my website, terrypatton.com will take you there, or integralspiritualpractice.com, and click on events, and you can find out about that, as well as a seminar I've been invited to conduct in Brazil, July 25th through 29th out of Manaus. A group of 20 or so people will be gathering with me to practice and experience the Amazon rainforest. And then I'll also be participating in the Integral Community Seminar sponsored by Next Step Integral this August. So you can find out about all of those by clicking events at terrypatton.com or integralspiritualpractice.com. Please stay on the line through this call, and at the end, before we say goodbye, I'll let you know a little bit more about what's coming up. In 2 weeks, I'll be talking with visionary artist Alex Gray. In 3 weeks, we'll be doing a special discussion. Craig Hamilton will come onto the show to interview me about how my perspectives have changed over the 2 years I've been engaging these conversations and how that's affected my work. And I'll have much more to tell you at the end of the call. Okay. Let's take a look at our questions. well, here's an interesting question from Ernest Zito in Oakland. He says, it seems that any one significant nation can have veto power and prevent the implementation of Simpol. What do you think of more unilateral actions such as a carbon tariff or bilateral agreements such as between China and the United States on climate change and renewable energy technology? It seems a lot simpler to implement.
Yep. Well, I would say if they can do a unilateral agreement, do it. You know, and Simpol doesn't, you know, it works in parallel to whatever else is going on. So, you know, if some unilateral agreements can be reached, then that's terrific. My guess, however, is that because of the global competition problem, you know, that's going to be extremely difficult for nations to organize on their own because they are, by definition, nation-centric rather than world-centric. And as far as the veto power is concerned, I would say that you have to remember that with SimPoll, we are talking about citizens using their votes in a way that makes it in the vital electoral survival interests of politicians to sign up to it. And therefore, once politicians really have no choice. With SimPoll, they become passive conduits for implementing what we citizens decide. And when it comes to implementation, you know, would a nation veto? Well, they might, but I think by that time, you know, global problems are going to be so acute that the pressure for cooperation is going to be so strong that the idea of vetoing will just, you know, just won't be seen as being in anybody's interests. So, you know, I think when we that question, I would suggest, comes from a position of today. We're looking at the problem as how it would be today, whereas what we need to imagine is, let's imagine when the water's a bit much more up to our necks around the world, and you know the simultaneous policy is being negotiated. Would a nation veto it? I don't think so, because it's going to be in everybody's interest to cooperate.
Okay. Well, here, let's go to a live question. We have one. I don't have your name, but your area code is 951, and I've just unmuted you. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Terry. This is Brian McConnell. Hi, John.
Hi there.
I'm really fascinated by the prospect of SimPoll at a level of meta systemic reform. It seems to me that in what we're seeing, particularly in Europe at this point, and I would venture in respect to kind of underlying structural flaws involving debt-based currencies, the euro. I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts in terms of, my sense in listening to the conversation to this point is that some of the prospects of introducing or enacting reform kind of at that level, it's almost taboo, you know, to talk about it or make reference to it. But nevertheless, I'm wondering about SimPoll's legitimacy or how the effectiveness really kind of pivots in relation to the scale, I think, that of crisis that we're looking at.
Yeah, well, thanks for your question there. There's quite a few things to say there. I mean, the first one I would say, this point about, you know, global governance or you know, the idea of nations, the all or sufficient nations implementing a policy simultaneously, it is kind of taboo. You know, it is kind of sounds fantastic, but you see, that's because our consciousness is still very much at a nation-centric level. You know, so the idea of global simultaneous implementation sounds to us pretty much as it must have sound, as national governance must have sounded to people in the Middle Ages before nation states were around. You know, so there is a kind of taboo barrier that we have to break through, and I would totally agree with you about that. As far as Europe and the problems with the euro are concerned, you know, again, I totally agree with you, and to me, you know, this is a perfect example of why we need simultaneous policy, because, you know, even the mighty EU is not big enough, it's not global enough to withstand global bond markets, you know, and so anything that is less than global is going to be at the mercy of anything that's already global. And bond markets are already global. So they are going to eat Europe alive. And you can see it already happening. And so, again, you know, nothing, to my mind, nothing short of some kind of global and simultaneous governance is really going to cut the mustard when it comes to stabilizing currencies or monetary reform, you know, really significant monetary reform of the kind I think you mean. And as far as the legitimacy of SIMPOL is concerned, well, that's right. It depends on us. It depends on citizens standing up saying, you know, I'm supporting SIMPOL. I'm going to be voting for any politician or party within reason that signs up to it, or if I have a party preference, I want my party to sign up to it. It's going to take us to stand up and say it, and through that, we will achieve the legitimacy. And as I said, you know, remember, many elections are being won, lost on fine margins, and so it actually won't take many of us to actually, you know, reach that tipping point. We don't need a majority. We just need the critical mass. So I hope that answers to some extent, at least.
It does. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Okay, turning to the questions that people have typed in. Got a number of people who are asking pretty similar question. Let me give it to you in the more extreme language. Jackie in Santa Cruz wrote in. In the United States, we do not trust our politicians when they sign anything. How do you expect us to trust them if they simply sign on to something? They break promises all the time.
Yeah.
Karen in Vashon more mildly says, how can we in the United States ensure that the politician who's committed to SIMPOL follows through, given the limitations and convolutions of the U.S. congressional system?
Yeah. Now, I'm glad Jackie asked that, because that's probably the most common question that people ask. And the answer is this. First of all, you've got to remember that when a politician signs on SIMPOL, he doesn't actually have to implement it until all sufficient nations are on board. So there is actually nothing for them to go back on at any point until the date for implementation of SIMPOL arrived. And also consider that, you know, let's be incredibly cynical about this. I mean, many politicians have actually signed on to SIMPOL because they actually think it's a great idea, and they're in quite safe seats here in the UK. But, you know, let's be cynical. There are some who've signed on because they were in very marginal seats. But the point is that if they signed on to SIMPOL just to get a few extra votes, the point is that if they then renege on it, if they then go back on it, they're only going to be inviting all the SIMPOL supporters never to vote for them again. And so it's just like cutting, you know, to go back on it would be to cut their own political throats. And so what you have to realize is, for politicians, it's a win-win. They don't have to implement it until all nations are on board. And, you know, at any point up until then, to go back on it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it seems to me, John, that you're describing a process that isn't so much about the final implementation. It's the building of an international consensus. Like,
absolutely.
If you can get a law passed in any significant nation that says that as soon as everybody else passes a law instituting, say, a carbon tax of X amount, we will. And then another country does the same thing. Then all of a sudden that attracts attention. And you're basically imagining that there can be a lot of momentum built fairly quickly. The hardest part of this process is building up enough interest in SIMPOL in just a country or two so that a law or two could get passed, because the publicity surrounding that would then be infectious. And you're kind of thinking that this has an asymptotic curve in terms of influence,
mm-hmm.
and momentum. Is that accurate?
You are absolutely right, Terry. I couldn't have put it better myself. It's building that momentum, and it's actually because, you know, as I was talking about the critical mass, we don't need a majority. We only need the critical mass in any electoral area or nation, and that means that the publicity ceiling through which we need to break is actually quite low. you know, I mean, for example, when I said to you in the UK, we had 200 candidates sign up and 24 of them are now sitting in Parliament, you know, the number of us that it took to do that was tiny. And so the agency that Simpol has, the leverage that it can exert, if just even a relatively small number of us get with the plan, is quite amazing. It's quite powerful. And that will then help to build that momentum. And as you say, Terry, it's an I will if you will proposition. You know, I will if you will. It's as simple as that.
Great. Well, thank you. Let me ask another question. A fellow named David Kaufman from San Antonio typed in a couple of questions. At first, he said, hey, you're only talking about why to do this, and you're singing to the Enlightened Activist Choir. How do you do this? And then he goes on and says, action will create what theory cannot solve. Jomo says, he's quoting Jomo Kenyatta. Get on with it. Get out of your minds. How about a clarion call? Globally, we are not far from massive civil unrest, and all global systems are accelerating toward collapse. This is not a mind game. Now, he doesn't turn that into a question, but I think it suggests to me a question, which is, Simpol kind of presumes the preservation of civil order and democratic institutions and a preemptory, proactive, creative response to problems before they've swamped us, whereas history shows that very often the, you know, events overtake planning, and that the windows of opportunity for more fundamental systems redesign only open when there are breakdowns of a larger kind. Have you thought about how Simpol is going to interact with major catastrophic events, including massive civil unrest or other dramatic or catastrophic events, and how have you accounted for that?
Yeah, well, you see, if it's a very good question. I mean, if things get, you know, I call it the water level, you know, the chaos level, if it gets too high, we're all done for. You know, we're finished. We're out. We're done. We'll be wiped off, well, pretty much wiped off the planet. The other alternative, the second alternative, is that in response to that, governments and corporations implement some kind of world government, which is not democratic, but is just a knee-jerk response to that chaos. And the third alternative, Terry, is something, is Simpol or something like it, where citizens, enlightened citizens, take the lead, you know, in response to the question, which is a good question. We are doing it now. That's what I've been telling you about, what we're doing in the UK, and we want everyone in, you know, in the US and in other countries to start doing it too. We've got the campaign launching in Germany next month. You know, this, you know, Simpol, if you like, is creating, I would say, like a life raft. It's cobbled together with rope and twine, and it's made of bits of rotten wood and God knows what. It's not a beautiful ocean liner. It's just a simple raft, so that when things start, you know, when the chaos starts to bubble up, there's something for us to jump onto. You know, there's something for us to politically take us through to the next level.
So you see this as perhaps building some momentum under current conditions, but it may be that it will actually accelerate under those chaotic conditions.
Absolutely. You know, Terry, it's not Simpol that, or something like Simpol that will save the planet. It's, you know, Simpol can only put the life raft there. We can only, you know, us lead people at the leading edge, we can put the life raft there. We can cobble it together. But it's global circumstances. It's the worsening life conditions that will really make the wind blow and will really put wind in the sails of that life raft. Did you see what I'm saying? So it's a gamble, of course, because we, you know, well, this is evolution. We don't know. We don't know which of the three scenarios is going to happen, whether we go down the tubes, whether we get an authoritarian world government, or whether we get some kind of people-centered governance along the lines of Simpol. You know, frankly, I personally, I don't like, you know, I'm aware of those different options, but I just say I'm going to get on with the Simpol option, even though today it may look like the least likely of the three.
Mm.
You know, I mean, what else are we supposed to do, you know?
Mm.
So I totally resonate with that question. I would just say, you know, that if we don't start creating a political life raft, a world-centric political life raft like Simpol, then we are definitely closing ourselves off to the other two options, which are either total overwhelmed by total chaos or some kind of like authoritarian world government, which, you know, nobody is going to be particularly happy with.
Right, right. Well, I want to take another live question, and this one has no identifying number associated with it. I just unmuted you, though. Please introduce yourself. Hello? If you pressed
Hello?
One. Yes, there you are.
Oh, hi. This is Gaylene calling from Vancouver Island. I'm wondering, I'm very inspired by what John's talking about on it's time now for people to step forward, and I'm looking at the critical mass idea. I'm wondering, John, if you've linked up with other groups. There's a Canadian-based direct action group called Avaz, and they're 5 years old. They've hit 13 million in their community online, and they do direct action. So they'll pick an issue, and they'll engender a large group response saying, hey, do this action, whatever it might be, on social change or environmental issues. And they appear to be
You're breaking up.
To break up, Gaylene.
But I think I got the question, Gaylene. Hello?
Yeah, Gaylene, I'm going to have to mute you for now. If you're able to get to a place where we have better reception, we'll come back. Maybe you can respond to John. But John, why don't you go ahead and respond to what she's said so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely, you know, Avaz, we're very much aware of Avaz, and you know, they're doing a great job in terms of, you know, like online petitioning and email petitions and so forth. And, you know, we would really like them to give us a hand because, you know, they have a great outreach system, much more powerful than ours. But, you know, what I think we have to realize is that you know, clicktivism or online petitions and of the kind that Avaz are doing, which are very good, but at the end of the day, they are just petitions. They are not your nationally valid vote. You see, and at the end of the day, what politicians respond to are your votes, and Simpol interfaces directly with that. So it's much, much more powerful. It's a much, much more compelling tool to use than an online petition. But the tool that Avaz represents, you know, their way of working is great. And I think that's, you know, put those two things together, and I think we could, you know, we could have a really potent combination.
Okay, I'm going to unmute you again, Gaylene. If you've gotten to a place where you have better reception, maybe we can hear you. You're unmuted.
Is this better?
Alas, it isn't. We heard you clearly at first, but it seems we've lost that. But thank you for that question. I'd like to ask a follow-up question on Gaylene's question, John, which is, are you contacting, like, it would seem to me that perhaps part of the work of organizing Simpol that would be most effective would be to try to enlist the excitement of the most effective organizers active today, such as Avaz, such that they would embrace Simpol, because you, in a sense, are reinventing the wheel, trying to build popular support for Simpol independently when there are so many global activist groups or national activist groups like Move On in the United States, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I agree, and I think, you know, what we have, I think, is the underlying strategic thinking and the interface with the with people's vote. You know, that is critical. That's the unique thing that Simpol offers, I think, is a way of transcending and including our national vote and bringing it renewed power and at the global level. And if you link that up with Move On and Avaaz, which I would very much like to do, Terry, believe me, I've written to them a few times, but without much response. I agree with you. I think it would be a very powerful proposition. Absolutely.
Well, I want to ask a couple of additional questions. One comes from Anna in Portoroz, I'm probably mispronouncing the name of the town, Portoroz, Slovenia. How can we make people accept lowering their standard of living for the sake of the global environment? Look at the mass movements in Europe right now. So much resistance and violence only over the thin, most urgent changes that the governments are proposing.
Okay. Well, I think there's a couple of points there. One is that, you know, one of the reasons that standard of living is under threat is because of the social injustice of the gap between rich and poor that you're seeing around the world. I mean, that gap is getting wider and wider and wider. So part of the problem is how do you even up standard of livings and incomes between rich and poor? And again, you can only do that with some kind of global solution, because all the while you try to do it nationally, the rich and the powerful can, of course, move somewhere else. So you need a global solution to even up the score on incomes and standards of living around the world. But I think on the deeper question of, you know, does a sustainable global environment mean a lower standard of living? Well, I don't know. I'm not so sure. I mean, in some ways, I think it would do. It might mean that, you know, we don't have so many cars, but it also might mean we don't have to use them so much because we perhaps have more leisure time, or because we, you know, are interested in other things rather than, you know, rushing around, you know, doing the things that we do now. You know, so I you know, that's something that is an open question. My feeling is that if the world learns to cooperate and to redistribute wealth more equitably and to implement a lot of the other measures that are needed, I think we will open up for ourselves a completely new way of living that might not resemble what we today regard as being a high standard of living, but it might be a very high standard. It'll be an even higher standard of living in terms of the time we have, the quality of our relationships, the environment that we can enjoy. So I think it would be a reinterpretation of a standard of living rather than necessarily a lower standard of living. And let me add, Anna, that, you know, if the world is cooperating, think of the billions that are going to be saved on military spending. You know, we're not going to need most of that, and that all of that money can be redirected into improving standards of living in poorer countries.
Yeah. Well,
so, you know,
of slips between cup and lip. There's a long way to go from here to there.
Oh yeah. No. That's right. I'm just trying to address the general point that, you know, does global sustainability mean we're all going to have to sacrifice our standard of living? And I'm just, you know, I would question that. I think it may mean a reinterpretation of what we mean by a high standard.
Okay. Well, let me ask there a flood of questions have arrived just a little after when I initially asked for them, and so some of them are really quite excellent. There's two comments from, I think the first is named Mary in Guatemala City, who agrees with the basic premise, but she doesn't agree with the win-win situation. That's not community organism, not what we believe in the Christian tradition. In order for this to succeed, everybody has to give and has to sacrifice. But then in the second comment seems to go on and says, Exactly. We are at the beginning of one of the most important evolutionary challenges to the human race since the shift from hunter-gatherers to civilization. Nothing less than a global economic and monetary system will be able to deal with the challenges. Our systems of unequal distribution and funny money will deal with our depletion of resources. They require a global polity. I don't hear any urgency, although global warming will create that. What we need now are our best systems thinkers building models. Now, that's an interesting assertion. There are a lot of people who think that the work right now is establishing a new evolutionary and integral worldview and the spare parts from which we can assemble a more sustainable human presence on the planet as we see breakdowns of existing institutions and systems. What do you think of that?
Well, I agree. I mean, I would see Simpol as part of that. You know, I would see Simpol as part of that evolutionary process. You know, as Ken Wilber has pointed out, you know, holons the holarchy has greater depth and greater span. You know, so we've moved from families to tribes to middle-aged small states to nation states. You know, each move was a bigger expansion. Right now, we're kind of evolutionarily, we're fumbling around with ideas like the EU and the UN. But ultimately, what I've been talking about, Terry, these last hour really is that we're going to need some kind of global governance, some kind of global system. That's the next evolutionary step. So I think Simpol is very much just a part of that natural process. And coming back to Mary's question about, you know, when I say win-win, I'm not saying necessarily that no sacrifice would be involved. I think, you know, some nations and peoples perhaps will have to sacrifice some things, but they will gain other things. You know, there has to be a kind of quid pro quo. And I don't think that necessarily, you know, when we cooperate, we open up all sorts of possibilities that we didn't see when we competed. And so I'm not saying sacrifice wouldn't necessarily be involved, but I think there would be compensatory prizes as well, if you like. And I don't see that as being Christian or unchristian. I see that as being deeply, you know, we're all in this together. It's a deeply human, deeply spiritual, you know, we are all one. You know, I think global cooperation, to me, is a bit like the proto-cell becoming a nucleated cell. You know, before the nucleated cell that we're all made of, the proto-cells had little organelles inside that were all competing each other to death and the whole cell to death. And then along came the nucleus, which was another organelle within the protocell, and sort of said, "Hey guys, what could we do if we all cooperated?" And somehow, together, simultaneously, I would suggest, you know, that the protocell became a nucleated cell. It started to globally govern itself, and we as a whole planet are in much the same, you know, facing that same transition now.
Well, there are a rich array of questions, and folks who have typed in questions, I'm going to send those to John, and there are a couple of people waiting to ask live questions. I wish we could get to you. I want to ask you one question to finish up. We've gone a little late, but Suzanne in Marysville, Tennessee asks a very simple and, I think, useful question. Looking at your goals from levels of consciousness, what do you see in our global community as the major roadblocks to Simpol's progress?
Consciousness, no doubt about it, Suzanne. Consciousness. You know, as I say, most people today are stuck at what I would call a nation-centric level of consciousness in a civic or political sense. We still somehow secretly believe that our governments have significant power to solve these issues. But when you move to a world-centric level, you realize that they don't. You know, that they're really stuck in this vicious circle. And, you know, so when people move to that world-centric level of consciousness, which is scary because it means we have to take responsibility, that we have to get into the cockpit, it's scary, which is why people don't want to go there. But when they do, they see Simpol as second nature. They get it straight away, you know. So the biggest roadblock, I would say, is moving, releasing ourselves from that nation-centric level of consciousness and moving to a deeper, broader, world-centric level in which we see that we're all one, that we all have to cooperate, and that actually we can do that. That we can, through that voting process and the policy development process that I describe, offers us one way that we can perhaps do that. Terry,
wow.
Can I just say, I promise I will answer every single question that you send to me. It may take
okay.
me a while, but thank you for everybody for having asked and for having taken time. And thank you, Terry, for really, you know, giving me this opportunity. And,
well, thank you, John.
I think
we're moving something important forward. Before I tell you what's coming up in the next little while, a couple of reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for free for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Simpol, please visit simpol.org. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter. And if you click events, you can find details, some, you know, rich consideration even, about the Integral Leadership Seminar that I'll be leading in British Columbia, Canada at Hollyhock, June 15th through 20th, and the Amazon Journey I'll be leading July 25th through 29th out of Manaus, Brazil, as well as the Integral Community event that will be taking place in Colorado in August. Now, some detail about what's going to be coming up on this series. In 2 weeks, May 26th, I'll speak with the renowned visionary artist Alex Gray, who's widely known for his revelatory artworks, making use of his uncanny ability to picture the human energy body with the detail and specificity of a medical illustration. On June 3rd, we'll be doing this turnaround, and I'll be the interviewee, and Craig Hamilton will be joining me to interview me about how these conversations have informed my own thought and teachings. On June 10th, I'll be having a conversation about the future of human evolution with Esalen founder Michael Murphy, the creator of Integral Transformative Practice and the author of The Future of the Body and Golf in the Kingdom. On June 24th, I'll be talking with Carter Phipps, author of an important book that's just now being released, Evolutionaries. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, John, and goodbye, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Terry.